Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming back after lunch. So I'm going to run through a few things today, try to keep it as interesting as possible, and share with you a little bit of a life story and an evolution, and show you where we've ended up after 25 years of thinking. I have to tell you a story to tell you a story. I started off as a dairy farmer's son on a farm in Ireland with very little resources and an even slower modem connection. And by 13, I started getting a little curious. So I managed to download the blueprints of Spaceship Columbia from one of NASA's machines, which got me a visit from them, and they're still my customer to this day. By 16, the Bank of England had asked me to test SWIFT, which is what you all use for bank wires and transfers. I was able to add zeros and redirect where it arrived, kind of relevant when it comes to wires. I was a busy kid while I was in high school, did a few other things, invented a couple of different technologies that led into various companies and buyouts over time. And then, as Thomas kindly mentioned, I decided I wanted to come to the US, but didn't have a family here to sponsor me and didn't want to be a slave to the same company on a H-1 visa, so I got a different kind of visa, an EB-1-1. A couple of other companies then took notice, and they started getting involved in everything from supply chain planning, e-commerce systems, credit card processing, you name it. Also, in the bottom here, did the Olympics in programming, and yes, there is a Geek Olympics. So I always try and take a step back at least once a year and think about, well, what's the purpose of what I'm doing? And for most people in this room, it would apply to them too, that at some point you reach the upper part of Maslow's hierarchy of needs and figure out you don't need to worry about surviving or paying the rent anymore. So now what's your purpose? And what I realized is that most people's answer to that question is some version of having the largest positive impact on society they can before they die. For me, when I looked at that, it seemed to make sense that if I could treat intelligence as a precious commodity and make it available to funded problems, it would allow me to alleviate some of the pain that some of my colleagues felt. So let me explain this a little better. An IQ of 150 is one in 10,000 people. In order to be empathized with, someone needs to understand you completely. So being genius is not all it's cracked up to be. It's also a very, very lonely place to be. And when your IQ is 1 in 1.5 billion, it gets even lonelier. You don't fit in at school. You don't fit in at home. Making friends is almost impossible. The higher your IQ, the lower your EQ, or emotional quotient. So you can't read people. You can't communicate well. You don't know why. And you can't tell when people are lying to you, and people can be cruel when you're dealing with the masses. So I decided to re-engineer myself and study EQ. Since my IQ wasn't going to change, what would happen if I tried to bring my EQ up to an average level? And then what if I tried to work with the other children in the Gifted Children's Society, who were all over 150, and teach them the same tricks that I learned about myself to make them more functional with each other and in society? Then effectively I'd learn to manage prodigies and I'd learn to harness intelligence, which leads to the last line here, would allow me to run a sustainable home for the mentally enabled. So I'll diverge a little bit here because I'm telling the backstory rapidly so I can tell you where we're at now as soon as possible. So firstly, the few scary facts from cybersecurity. Having been a hacker, I now spend a lot of my time helping people with their security and trying to make systems not hack-proof, because that's a hard claim to make. So the best I can do is say, I can't get in anymore, and most people are pretty happy with that. And some things to be aware of for yourselves, your families, and your kids. Facebook is a hacker's paradise. It'll tell me where you're born, your family members, your first car, names of your pets, your best friend of high school, location of your daughter's ballet practice every Friday. Not good information to be putting out there to people. Also, you'll find that that harmless button, the like button of clicking on things you like, studies at Microsoft and Cambridge show you that That allows me to predict your sexual orientation, intelligence, stability, religion, alcohol, substance abuse, relationship status, age, gender, and politics. And that'll play into careers and hiring and so, all kinds of information as that becomes more available to the recruiting firms. You'll read online, many people asking for a Facebook password before they'll hire someone so they can see your post. Also, if they don't give me the password, getting a password to these things is also surprisingly easy. Moore's Law means that the technology we're using is getting faster and faster and cheaper every year. So things that used to take 10 years to crack a password have come down considerably now, where your typical passwords can take less than 20 minutes to hack, just brute forcing them. And that includes to your Wi-Fi, which means I can just park outside your house and pull data that way. Which is what Google does, which is why they know your location, even though your GPS is turned off on your phone, because they've already picked up on where your Wi-Fi router is based on the cars that drive by doing the Google Street View. And they actually pick up on the strength. So as they drive down your street, they go, okay, I got his Wi-Fi, one bar, two bars, three bars, two bars, one bar. Okay, he must be where the signal was strongest. So they can locate you within about 30 feet, even though you think you've turned off your locator. One of the interesting things here I need to point out with all the asterisks at the bottom here, should probably put a few more on it, is there's a website called howsecureismypassword.net where you can type in your password and it'll tell you how many minutes it'll take to crack it. Do not go there and start typing in all your passwords. That's another hacker's trick. For those of you that caught the video at the beginning, I was on the evening news explaining how the kind of technology we develop is used to do a lot of things, which I'll show you, including identify the Boston bombers. And that allows us to take video forensics like this, turn it into edge detection so we can see all the edges of everything. And the problem with video, like in the Boston bombing, you had 4,000 hours of footage, you can't watch it all fast enough in order to capture the target. And the reason for that is most of it you don't want to watch. So the trick is, how do I identify all the video where nothing interesting is happening? And I do that by locating the edges and the objects and then proving what objects don't move. And if nothing's moved and nobody's run around or gone anywhere, then it's much easier for me to be able to prove that we can delete that video and focus on when people do move. And then use motion flow analysis to see who moved early, who moved differently than everyone else, who acted suspiciously, who didn't act surprised, and that's how you identify suspicious behavior. Now, this kind of technology, when we do it for the Air Force, is called OOI, Objects of Interest. So you can identify suspicious behavior. You see here on the left, the bottom, people leaving objects, even underwater, and walking away. Cars making multiple U-turns in front of an embassy. And these are things you can spot from drones or from 30,000 feet where it's a staging for a car bombing or a car rapidly moving across the city but not using any of the major roads. So we identify OOIs and how to capture them. One interesting one was for a certain sheriff's department, they asked us to identify marijuana fields. As you can see in the regular photo on top left, it's pretty much the same shade of green as everything else. But when we went to thermal cameras, apparently growing marijuana effectively requires micro-irrigation systems that supply water to each plant. And that water is cooler temperature, so we can see that irrigation system show up as a dense bunch of blue dots. Now, that's either marijuana or strawberries, and there wasn't that many strawberries being grown in that state. More seriously, when you take surveillance from a Global Hawk drone, here we see someone leaving one city with a large backpack on, and it starts tracking that and flying beyond recognition at the height of tracking that person, seeing where they went, noticing two white pixels moving in parallel, which we've programmed the system and taught it to look for, somewhere in the middle of the trip, and then arriving in the other city with no backpack on. That person, the authorities were notified, that person was picked up. The system sent them a GPS location of where they saw the two white pixels moving together. Those two white pixels were his hands digging a hole to plant that IED next to the road. So they went back and defused that IED before anyone got hurt. One of the other technologies we invented won most innovative product of the year for the last 2 years, and we're still learning how many things this applies to. It's called SenGen, stands for Scenario Generator. And the simple explanation is, picture two chess computers playing each other. They would rapidly and exhaustively play every possible game of chess. Now, if we abstracted from that the rules of chess into a modeling language, I can now build a model of any scenario, and this system will play out every possibility or everything that can happen from there. This has been used in finding flaws in partnership contracts, legal documents, divorces, writing TV scripts, mostly developed for testing systems or trading systems or ideas where you want, if you have a large system that you rely on and you release new versions of it every other Friday, how do you know you didn't break it? How do you know something wasn't wrong? Or you have a system you've been using for billing or insurance or credit card underwriting that's voodoo at this point because people have been tweaking it for 20 years and you're about to move it over to a brand new system because you need to upgrade it. How do you know you can trust the new system? Well, this will generate every possible scenario and every customer on the old system and on a new one and tell you that the new one is mathematically no worse. So you can effectively prove moving forward with software that you haven't made it worse, you haven't broken it. And that's kind of valuable. We also used it for mission planning. If any of you were unfortunate enough to have to go to Afghanistan tomorrow, you get a white paper called the Afghan Network. And it'll brief you on the lay of the land, literally. North, south, east, west, hot days, cold nights, the weather can be dry or wet. You got the good guys on the left, the allies, the insurgents on the right. The civil authorities, you'll see, are in both, depending on who paid them last. Transportation, and any actions. We do searching, defending, raiding, road blocking. They do car bombing, murder, suicide bombing. Oops. Biological contamination. So once I broke this into my little chess game, I was able to run SenGen on generating all mission planning and all war game scenarios for Afghanistan. We did that. One of the ones that came up with was pretty interesting, and we showed this to the Rear Admirals, which is here you've got an IP network managing drones and communication, terrorist cell with a $35 laptop that applies a denial of service attack that causes the drone that it can't communicate. The drone crashes into the terrorist source of funding, which is a poppy field. Because that's classified technology, the guys in the Humvee go out to go get it. They follow standard operating procedure, which is to burn down the poppy field. Local drug lords aren't too crazy about that. So to react on the local base, they do biological contamination of arsenic in the water supply to the base. And that would mean everyone on the base, about 400 people, would be dead in 2 days. So the system predicted this. We laid it out as a mission planning, saying, what's your precautions for this? They had no precaution. Nobody had thought of it before. They said, what do we recommend? I said, a week-long water reservoir that you've screened in advance, arsenic detectors, and a valve that can switch between the two. So we put all that in place. 3 months later, we got an alert that that valve switched over, and this is exactly what had happened. So then we took a plane to take care of it, which malfunctioned, and we took some helis, and that took care of it. I'm not an artist. This is as good as my animation's going to get. Same thing's applied to the command and control system for the U.S. Navy now, which has saved over 28 friendly fire incidents, where, again, it's a case of trying to eliminate human error. So facial recognition for casinos, blacklisting people from entering casinos. So I started thinking, okay, great, I've done all of this, what's my next act, what's my second act? And some of you may ask yourselves the same question at different points in your life. I've got a few good clients, I've got a decent track record, I've got people now, 2,600 people that we can pull from that have proven skills that you need to solve any kind of problem. So then I thought, maybe I should move from solving any technical problem to just solving any problem, period. Because what engineers are classically trained to do is turn ambiguity into absolute. Take a fuzzy idea and break it down into ones and zeros and wrestle it down to the ground. It's kind of a useful skill for anything you need done. And I try to visualize our lives as it grows more complex. And this is how I visualized it, what I call my ambiguity triangle. At the tip of the spear here is your core competency. things each of you are better at than I'll ever be. At the bottom of this are well-defined tasks that it's easy for you to give to your secretary or assistant or concierge. In the middle is a whole bunch of fuzzy ideas, hypotheses, concepts you came up with that you didn't have time to flesh out or look into. You don't know what they cost, and you don't know if they're feasible. So they drop to the bottom of your to-do list for years. You haven't thought them through enough to delegate them to anyone else, and you need someone to look into them as your level of contacts, common sense, and intelligence in order to flesh it out enough to see if it makes sense. We take this middle layer off your hands, and we call it Concierge Up. It opens the Scorpion think tank to the general public. Normally, you concierge down tasks that are too simple to do yourself. Now you can concierge up tasks that are too complex or you don't have the time to do. Examples of this. I want to take all my data, secure it in a vault where even the government can't subpoena the information. Here's another true story. Family in Beverly Hills, their daughter wanted to be a journalist, went to journalism school, and at 21 ran away to cover the troubles in Libya, ended up being put in a prison over there. They went over to bail her out. There is no bail system for activists, and her waiting time for her day in court is 2 years. They came to us and said, this is a funded problem. I'd like my daughter home, please. She was home in 48 hours. We partnered with the largest private military organizations in the U.S. We do their digital security. They do our physical security. So we can arrange forced extractions. On the tail of that, they said, why don't you GPS tag all my kids all the time and all their shoes? Some other gentleman came to us and said, we like horse racing, the sport of kings. However, can you increase the odds of the horses we choose to train? So we went down the track, stared at it, and I said, this is a big data problem. When I look at Formula One racing, they plug a laptop into that car when it pulls over and pulls all the telemetry. Nobody plugs a laptop into a horse. It's about time we did. So we measured their lung capacity, heart capacity, adrenaline storage, their DNA. We found the gene for muscle mass and density, so you know before a horse is born if it can be a horse. The size of its hind end, which shows you the size of its thighs, effectively. We put iPhones on their back so we knew when they're galloping if their spine's aligned or not. Then they came back to us and said, a smart horse is a good horse. It has to be able to pace itself and be trained and learn. So we came up with two ways of measuring horses' IQ. I'll leave that as my teaser to everyone. You can all come up and ask me what was the two ways of measuring the IQ. This has won the Breeders' Cup for the last 4 years in a row. Any money I didn't make on the margin on the project, I made betting on the horse to place. Build me a command center. Put a shark tank in my office. I'm deliberately mixing up here trivial, fun things to do with extremely serious things. Because to us, all problems are the same. Analyze them, break them down, break them into tasks, track them carefully, and apply intelligence to it. Build me a casino overseas, everything from the real estate development to the pool cleaner to the reservation systems. If you have enough going on, you need someone intelligent to manage that. They need to go to Vegas, put a dream team together, and form the checklist of the 2,000 things you need to have, including soap, when you put a hotel together. I want to make a documentary movie about my life or my cause. I want to choose a sports car that matches my personality, just like pets match their owners. How can you do that with someone who's not actually a car salesperson? I want to put a secret room in my house that doubles as a panic room. Now remember, we turn ambiguity into absolute. So the more ambiguous your request, the more we can help you. That means instead of coming to us saying, I think I figured this out and I want you to build this, we prefer you to say, just tell me what the problem is. I'll give you some extreme examples of that in a moment. One of them is, I just want to be happy. What is happiness? What is the happiness infrastructure? 20% family, 10% work, 10% vacation, 20% hobbies. What is that mixture, and how can I engineer my life that way? And a lot of this, we found, is not about genius or about being smart. I can probably fix your life, and you could probably fix my life better than we can fix our own, because we're objective about it and emotionally removed from it. I want my business to not need me anymore. Engineer how I retire. I'm not saying where you invest your retirement money. It's a case of how do I put a group of people in place that'll run the company at least no worse than how I've run the company. Some other examples. I want someone to handle my divorce, and I want to be my wife to be conflicted out of every divorce attorney in town because I hired them all and put them on retainer. Fix my friend's life or business. Retire my parents, buy them a house in Florida, shut down their business, liquidate their assets, move them there, give them a Cadillac and an assistant, and call me when you're done. Find a family member. I've done this a few times now using DNA databases, even people who are adopted who didn't know who their parents were. We found out what country they're from, their medical history, and that they had a cousin. I've had two calls this year saying they want to be U.S. president. Obama has 25 million followers. Some other people only have 1.5 million. That's a social media problem. The last one I like is this young lady who panicked because her mom had died giving birth to her. Her father died in a car accident. She was 24. She just inherited a couple of newspapers and a couple of agencies. She wasn't a business person. She was an art student. People were stealing from her, suing her, and things were falling apart. So she was told by friends to go talk to me. Sometimes I feel like I'm the principal's office and people are sent to talk to me. And I sit her down and she keeps panicking about the business. And I kept trying to ask her, what do you want? And a third time she heard me, said, I just want to live in a little condo by the beach, work in a coffee shop a couple of days a week so I can meet people and do my artwork. I said, okay, so you need $1.2 million in mutual funds, run off 10% after taxes and own half your condo and then you'll be stable for the rest of your life. So let me take your inheritance, figure out whether I digitize it, sell it, run it, do something to get at least that much money out of it, and then you'll be happy. We'll fix your life. She asked me if I knew anything about running newspapers. I said, absolutely not. But what are the chances with me and my resources of screwing this up versus her? She said, good point. So what's on your to-do list, bucket list, or wish list? And what's your next act? And that's basically what Concierge Up is all about. It's a very simple concept that it takes a while for people to wrap their head around because they keep coming to me going, do you do this? Do you do that? It's any funded problem. One other example I'll throw out there is we had a billionaire whose son had fallen in love with the wrong Ukrainian gold digger. The father wasn't too happy about it, but didn't want to drive a wedge between him and his son. So we went ahead and made her have a new friend where she disclosed her real boyfriend was in the Ukraine. She was planning to bring him over after she got her green card and took the son for a ride. We got that recorded. Then we went ahead and had the son make a new friend. It's pretty easy to arrange that if you go to Starbucks often enough every morning. We then used a psychologist to have the father push the buttons on a Thursday night of the son by reading out a script that he had rehearsed of saying all the wrong things to the son. Next morning, the son's friend was on a private jet to Dominican Republic. So he said, let's go, why don't you take your girlfriend and elope with no prenup and go get married? So they did. Came back. After the honeymoon and everything else settled down, she filed for divorce. After her green card application was confirmed that it's in processing, started communicating with her boyfriend, and then we sat her down in my legal offices, and she was expecting her divorce settlement. We showed her the contract for the priest we hired, who was an actor, which null and voided her wedding, which never actually happened. Gave her a one-way ticket and a gag order back to Ukraine, and her letter from Homeland Security being banned for 10 years for immigration fraud since she'd filed for a green card having not been married. Any funded problem. So I don't know, Angelo, how I'm doing on time, but is this a good time to break for questions? Boy. Maybe Angelo's left, so I break for questions. Ethical boundaries? That's a great question. One second, I'm just checking. I have enough time to answer that. So we have what we call a fairness algorithm that we calculate the greater good. with, and we apply that in each case. So we're not bound by a particular religion or morals or beliefs. We more or less try to quantify fairness in the world and say, is this a better or worse place when we do the math on this situation? So if she, in the last story, had not disclosed that she was intentionally taking him for a ride and really planning to be with her other boyfriend, then we wouldn't have executed the operation. So we do our homework to make sure that we're doing the greater good according to our calculation, not according to anyone else's. Alex? Good, that's a good question. We've had a lot of experience working with customers over the years, and we decided that the best way to work on this was to kind of stand our ground in terms of being as good as we say we are. So there is no lock-in, no deposit, no big fee, no contracts that lock you into working with us. We basically took the Pac-Man arcade machine approach. You can buy tokens with us, which are about $150 each. It comes out to an average hourly cost between the juniors and seniors. And you buy a bunch of tokens, as little as $5,000 or $10,000 to start. And you work with us. And every week or every Friday, we'll give you a status on where we are with everything we're engineering in your life. And at any point, you can pull the plug and not put in more tokens. If you like playing, you keep putting in more tokens. And it's as simple as that. You fire us any given Friday, we're not providing value. Yes? Do we sometimes work for free? There is a certain amount of nonprofit work we've done. Recently, we've helped a lot of the child trafficking, the work around stopping child traffickers. We help provide certain special services that I can't go into for them. Some of the military and government work we've done, they ran out of hours long before we stopped working because we were applying the greater good formula. And generally, to most of our clients, I don't charge for my time. I try to provide that Coca-Cola formula, the 5% you need, and the other 95% of the work then is executed from there. That's generally how it works. Yes?
Have you had some outcomes that you weren't pleased with or that your clients weren't pleased with or that you would have rather changed to some degree?
We don't like surprises for ourselves or for our clients. So because we take a very agile approach to this, we don't promise anything 6 months from now or 12 months from now. We say at best we can plan the next 2 weeks and then check back and see where we're at. And we're pretty conservative on, you know, as Einstein said, if we knew what we were doing, it wouldn't be called research, would it? So we are pretty conservative on what we'll promise to a client and say, you know, this here we know works because we've done it 10 times. This here, you came to us because no one's ever done it before. And that's where we work very carefully in terms of how we set and meet expectations. So there aren't usually big disappointments. The big disappointments tend to come, we have a 240-point inspection. It's an extreme due diligence that we do in 2 days on a company that someone's either invested in and planning on pulling the plug or planning to invest in. And these are things that won't be in the audited financials. You know, it's I believe in any merger or investment, the only people who aren't lying are the machines, and we're the machine whisperers. So we go into the logs and the accounts and find out what the machines are telling us about the business. And a customer is often very happy with our due diligence, but very disappointed in what we uncover, because we've blown up more deals than people have gone through with because of what we found was hidden. Yes, in the back?
Is there a God?
Is there a God? All right, putting me on the spot slightly. I have a different philosophy when it comes to salvation. I believe in making my own, so I work on the 2045 project for immortality. Short version of that is our brain is electrical activity running on a biological computer. If in the next 30 years I can shift that over into electrical activity running on a silicon computer, then I don't have to worry about God so much because I'm not going to die. And that's a weird claim to make unless someone goes to 2045.com and looks at the 22,000 people working on this and following it, or the cover of Time magazine, which it made. But the reason I like that project is the side effects. If we can move our consciousness back into a stem cell version of ourselves, then we've just cured every terminal disease. why work on AIDS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, HIV, cancer, if we can just throw away our body and move our consciousness to a new one? It solves all those problems with one silver bullet. There's a few other side effects too. So I have about 14 different companies. The main Scorpion and company, which is powering Concierge Up, is we have 2,600 consortium members that we can pull from. They're not all busy at the same time. One of the things that's behind this whole company, and Angelo, please stop me if I'm running out of time.
It's all good, Walter.
We're good?
You got time for a couple more questions.
Excellent. In order to make this work, I had to study why smart people quit. Why would they leave a company? And there's a few common reasons. Number one, they're bored. So I got hungry minds to feed. So I try to put them on three projects at the same time. That stops them being bored. Secondly, they feel unfairly treated. They reach an unfairness level that hits a certain threshold. So we quantified fairness, as I mentioned earlier. So let's say you're working on a project with me for three people. And at the end of the project, you come to me and say, I think I was unfairly compensated. The other two people didn't pull their weight. Well, because we track everything that we do and every hour we spend on each task, it's easy to prove that I say, prove it to me. And they show, yes, they did half the hours and half the code and had half the bugs. So, okay, that means I've been minus 16% unfair to them and plus 8% extra fair to the other two people when they all got 33% and a third. So they get a 16% pay rise in the next 1,000 hours that they do equivalent on the next project. That load balances their unfairness points to zero. The last thing is, if you do run a company full of smart people, a lot of them with hacking backgrounds, you don't try and keep secrets. And by the way, when we do try and recruit, we have certain harvesting methods for finding these people. One of them is we have a bunch of fake banks online in Europe, primarily, that have various security systems. And if they can break through all the security systems and get onto the bank's main network, there's only one file in the network. And it's a Word document that's a job offer to the security team. Yes, another question.
Can you speak a little bit about how tech today, how risky can be in the future finding, maybe a hacker, finding a crisis in the world just by a hacker?
I'll say that everything our former CIA gentleman said this morning is absolutely true. We work on the smart grid as well and several of those infrastructures. They're nowhere near as protected as they need to be. And unfortunately, our military will spend a lot more money on bending metal than they will on protecting things security-wise. So our technology and our drones and systems like that are wonderful when they're flying that direction until someone hacks in and turns them around and flies them back towards the coast here. That's not a fun day and no easy way to stop a system that was designed to have no single point of failure. So investing in technology is always speculative. You really need to, unfortunately, investing has traditionally been with using accountants and lawyers. People forget to actually ask an engineer. Reading the PowerPoint and the PPM will never tell you as much as getting someone to read the source code, finding out that the guy who wrote it doesn't even work there and isn't alive anymore. Those are the kind of things where due diligence on a technical level helps a lot. Technology is not going to stop. The cloud is not going to go away. Those systems are going to be more prevalent in the next 5 years, including all the things we thought is way in the future, in terms of robotics, artificial intelligence, replacing manual labor, et cetera, et cetera. Just look at Google's purchasing history in the last 18 months if you want to see what's going to happen next. You can put two and two together pretty quick by just looking at the billions they're spending acquiring these technologies to release them. So I'd say you just have to know what you're doing or know someone who knows what they're doing if you're investing in technology. And war is a great catalyst to invention. And I think cybercrime at the levels it's at right now is war and will be a catalyst to a whole new level of respect for technology. It's not just for geeks anymore.
What's your view on Bitcoin?
I thought I'd get through one more day without someone asking me that or where the Malaysian plane is. But my view on Bitcoin, it's one of the two methods governments use to control a country. They don't let go of that too easily and they don't cooperate with each other. So if you're going to trade it, make sure you close out at 5 o'clock every evening, because it may be illegal to convert it back into dollars by midnight that night, or convert it back into dollars overseas and bring that money back into the U.S. I think technically it's a wonderful system. It's beautifully, elegantly designed, so there's no technical issue with it. The issue, to me, is the people. Also, it's reasonably difficult to counterfeit paper money, but I could hand you a thumb drive right now claiming it's Bitcoin data, and how are you going to know? And as soon as people start spoofing and counterfeiting Bitcoin, everyone's going to shy away from it, because how do you know? Yeah? What do I fear? I fear that one of our biggest risks is our own technology being used against us. Not turning against us from an AI point of view, but just that other countries with other kids who think math is as cool as we think basketball is will turn that technology against us, and we don't have the government resources to react or protect fast enough to protect ourselves from ourselves. You know, peace means one guy's got the biggest stick, and we're building some pretty big sticks, but we may not always be the ones wielding them. Also for the U.S. in general, I mean, U.S. has given me the life that I like here, but I grew up watching MacGyver and the A-Team and Knight Rider and wanted to save the world. I can't imagine what happens when you grow up watching Kardashians and Jersey Shore, which is why the CBS show you saw here at the little clip that they showed at the beginning, the idea, a part of the benefit of that is to make math and science cool again. I think what I do is cool, and I think presented the right way, the next generation will think it's cool too. So just like the schools are full of CSI graduates now, 10 years from now I'd love to see them full of computer science graduates, and then we may have a hope.
Down here.
I cannot comment on any ongoing investigation. Sorry.
I guess we have time for one more question.
Do you have a view on the singularity as defined by Ray Kurzweil?
Yes. My view is it will happen. I hope it happens within my lifetime. Sorry, he asked about Ray Kurzweil's singularity theory, which is basically that computers and technology get to the point of being as smart or as capable as humans are. Our brains store about 2.5 petabytes of data and 1 trillion neurons. 12 years, an Intel chip will have 1 trillion transistors. 7 years, hard drives will have 2.5 petabytes of storage. So for $300, I can have a prosthetic brain instead of a prosthetic leg or prosthetic arm. And that changes what it means to be human and allows us to transcend. I think it will happen. I just don't know if it's 2045, 2065, or 2025. It's a little hard to predict that, but the fact that technology will surpass our capabilities and go from one machine being smarter than one person to one machine being smarter than all people on the planet simultaneously is likely to happen. Just take the last 20 years' trajectory and just plot it out a little further and see where it's going. It's consistently gaining on us, and we're consistently staying the same.